Have you ever dealt with a bank robber? Did it play out by the book? It's hard to prepare for all potential scenarios and identify all possible security risks. With branches that are more open and visitor-friendly, it's more important now than ever to ask yourself, are we prepared for the worst? I'm your host, Honey Shelton, and this is Training Matters.
Training Matters is brought to you by the Training Institute, dedicated to setting the standard for individuals responsible for training effectiveness in banks and credit unions across the country.
Today, I'm joined by an expert on risk assessment, someone known as the fraud educator, Barry Thompson from the Thompson Group. Barry and his firm focus on securing your bank or credit union branches and training your bank personnel how to handle robberies and internal fraud. Very excited to have you with us, Barry. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, thank you, honey. Well, I had been a banker for about 22 years when I was pulled out of the audience one day when the head speaker had a heart attack and asked to fill in for him. And the next thing I knew, I was doing training for a national outfit, and our firm kind of evolved from that. And we're actually the A to Z in security risk management for financial institutions. If a financial institution takes a loss, we're interested in it. If they have a security threat, we probably can help them. We work with anything from an active shooter right down to physical risk assessments and vulnerability studies. But primarily, we are the education firm for security. We do both in-house and associations and national associations across the country, where we do or prepare their training, their manuals, and generally have a pretty good time at working with our financial institutions.
Well, that sounds like you cover some topics that matter greatly to many of our followers. And let's start with one that is always in vogue, unfortunately, and that has to do with bank robbery. I'm curious, Barry, when you do your training, do you have best practices on how to prevent bank robbery?
Actually, we do. A lot of studies have been done recently about that. And we start training with staff about where sales and marketing merge right at the very beginning. When someone enters a financial institution, we always teach staff to look them right in the eye. It tells the individual coming in the door that they're being observed. We also teach people to think like a criminal. If they think like a criminal, particularly those who are involved with designing facilities, working with updating branches, then they begin to understand that sometimes we do things that make us inviting to a criminal. And what are some of those things? Well, we want to be able to see out the windows, see into the building. Some institutions will design marketing pieces that will actually block their windows. And while it may look great for marketing, it also looks great to the criminal. This is a place that I want to go in the door and do something. So one of the things that we like to do is borrow from, shall we say, Walmart. And that is when a criminal comes through the front doors, we like to have a monitor there where anybody can see themselves. The last thing a criminal wants to do is see what they look like and see how nice a picture we're taking of them. My goal when I'm working on these things is to drive the criminal to another location across the street, down the road, and have them rob somebody else. I also like to see height markers. A lot of institutions, and by golly, when I was running and working in one, I never liked a height marker. Didn't want it, didn't want to see it. And then when I got on this side and started doing consulting, one day I was talking to a bank robber. And the bank robber told me that he never robbed an institution that had a height marker. That took me by surprise. And when I asked him why, he responded, well, because I can tell they're prepared for me. And that told me, you got to think like the criminal. And the criminal looking at that knows that somebody has already taken time to figure out how they go. I didn't like it as a banker because I didn't want it making a mess of my lobby. But I have to tell you, it really is something that people have to pay attention to. And just about 2 days ago, I was talking with an individual who asked me about the fact that the entry door into his bank was kind of dark. In fact, all of his branches had been built that way. And he said, any kind of standard for lighting? And my response was quick. It's got to be bright as day. I want to be able to see people going through areas and going out of areas. And if it's not, then you're creating an inviting environment for that criminal element to enter your bank. And one last thing. I train people all the time that when you're helping someone and they ask you for something unusual, they ask you a question that's just off the wall, you know, or you see them walking around looking at your lobby and are looking at your cameras, or they're working and supposedly putting coin in the coin counter, but they're really turning around and watching you from the public coin counter. That person, you should take the pen immediately right in front of them, write down the time. That time becomes important if there's a robbery. We can go back to the cameras. We can find this individual looking at us. And there was a case in Texas where after the robbery occurred, they got the robbers. They came back into the bank. Police did the next day. And one teller who had left at noon the day before the robbery took place, handed them a piece of paper. And she said to them, you know, these are the times of unusual happenings. I don't know if you want to look at this or not. And they said, yeah, they did. And what they discovered was the robber's girlfriend had been inside the institution that morning, and she was looking for the location of cameras. And if the teller had not written that time down, she would not have gone to jail for being a part of the robber situation. So these are just a few things that you could be able to do.
Those are great suggestions, Barry. Thinking about all the change that's going on, especially at the branch, do you have any concerns with any of the new technology that's being deployed now? For example, the interactive teller machines?
Oh, very good question. The interactive teller machines are being deployed around the country, and it's really how the institution sets them up that's important. See, I've been in places where they're setting up these interactive teller machines, do not intend to have anybody in the rooms with them. They may have one location that I don't want to identify because of the bank, but they actually just decided to slap it into a room in an area where it's a high prostitution. So that brings into how are we going to secure the areas around this interactive teller machine. And the interactive teller machines, they do have a camera in them. This person can walk up and press the button, and I'm talking now about the NCR models. And at that point, we can see them from our call center. But we go one step further. The surveillance cameras in the room or in the branch have to be connected to a switch that when somebody enters or opens the door to enter this room, it automatically tells the call center person that somebody has entered. And we require that because if I'm being forced into the bank to make a withdrawal, not only do we have to see the person, we want to see who comes in with them and did somebody force them in. As we move in technology to remove our tellers and our people from actually being in front of the actual account holder, we run into another problem, and that is the criminal will start to attack our account holder to get money from the institution. The interactive teller machines, I really like them at places like drive-thrus. I like them if handled properly in the design of the building. And that's something that we do sometimes work with. Institutions will send us plans to look at. And we're not interested in looking at them if they've already finished the design and they have already agreed with the architect this is the best way to go. But early on in the planning stages, we do like to work with institutions. We have one institution that always sends us their floor plans of what they're doing. And in that way, we look for problems like I'm talking about now with the interactive teller machine. One of the other things that we're finding, and people are telling us regularly, is that if you have actual live tellers with these machines, people will never use the machine. So an institution really has to think about how they're going to implement the interactive teller machines and what they want to accomplish with their marketing plan.
You know, that brings to mind, too, that if fewer transactions are happening at the branch, or fewer customers are showing up, that both credit unions and banks are looking for how they can do things more efficiently and effectively. I have a special offer for you, our loyal listeners. Get 20% off any of our recorded webinars with this promo code, TRAININGMATTERS20. That's TRAININGMATTERS20. There are 3 brand new programs in our store that you can immediately use this promo code on. Closely related to today's topic is our BSA AML training for tellers. People who attended the program love the everyday examples that Zach Merrill brings forward. Tellers relate to these real-life cases that highlight how important BSA AML compliance is for them. Our second new CD-ROM is called Become the Employee You Expect Others to Be. Attendees rave about the eye-opening information that will improve working relationships among all staff. The last program I want to talk about is our revised Motivating and Managing the Frontline. Supervisors appreciate the how to, when to, and why to approach that motivates and encourages people in the branches and the call center. Use your promo code TRAININGMATTERS20 today to get 20% off all of these or any of our CD-ROM programs in the store. Write it down, TRAININGMATTERS20. What about the cash recyclers and cash dispensers? As they're coming into play in the branch, do you have any suggestions or recommendations around those?
Well, as a matter of fact, I do, because a lot of people put in the cash recyclers or cash dispenser without really thinking about what are we going to do in a robbery. And the first time I ever came across one a few years ago, I started to question the teller. When I'm doing reviews, I always talk to people about where they live, what they're seeing. And I asked the teller, I said, I'm a robber, and here's your note. What are you going to do? And she said to me, well, I'm going to give you the cash that's in my drawer that I take in during the day. Sometimes we don't put it into the recycler. I said, well, thank you. Surprised by that comment. And I said, but I still want more money. And that's really where a lot of people fall down in their training. They don't tell the person, the teller, what do you say or what do? When the robber requests more money. Mm-hmm. And this particular teller turned to me and said, well, I'm just going to put in code such and such. And I said, what's that do? Well, she said, it empties the recycling machine. So then you'd have $100,000 popping out of the machine. So what I acquired with people that I'm working with is that we dispense a certain amount of money from the machine, generally less than what they'll get in a local convenience store robbery. And you can find that out by talking with local law enforcement. So we want it so that it is less money being paid to me than I can do by going to another business. Secondly, and this is where most people fall down, is there's no markings on the machine. I always make them take and put a little sign on the machine, maybe a stamp that they can put on it, and it says, operator cannot open machine. And consequently, during the robbery, if the robber said to me, open that machine, I point to the sticker and say, I can't. How I get you more money is I have to go to the next operator because the machine locked down after it distributed whatever we handed the person. Many times, the robber just wants money and they will leave. And I only know of one case, honey, in the entire United States, and it happened in Syracuse, New York last year. The robber gave a particular demand to the teller of how much money he wanted. The teller gave him what she had. It wasn't what he wanted. He had left the bank. The police had arrived. Doors were locked. And as they're talking to the teller about the robbery, they look up and hear somebody knocking on the door. It's the criminal. He'd come back because he was short the amount of cash that he wanted, and he wanted them to give him cash. So there is a thing about dumb robbers, and that's basically what we see today with bank robberies. The days of Dillinger is over. Today we have people that are just desperate when they come in. It can always be interesting.
Well, that's a very recognizable story, Barry. At Interaction Training, we come across very similar situations, especially in our Essential Teller Issues workshop. In addition to what we've talked about, Barry, what should we consider when we shift away from the traditional branch? Pod branches are hot right now. What exactly is a pod branch, and what security issues come with them?
It's very interesting. I was sitting at a particular conference recently next to a construction company that tells me that all they have installed in the last 2 years has been pod branches. And a pod branch is a marketing delight in a way. What it is you will enter into the institution. They may have at the front door a couple of ATMs that they're using to give cash to people. When you walk in, they will have a small circular, either you can think of it as a desk or a small lectern type thing sitting in their lobbies. They'll have about four or five of them maybe. And beside each one will be standing a teller who at this point has been trained in marketing. And the idea is to market the different products that our people are looking for when they enter our institutions. And therefore, the actual teller may not be handling too many transactions. Or if they do, they do have a cash recycler or a cash dispenser sitting next to them. The idea is to make it warm, friendly, and answer questions, help people, much like a Verizon or Apple store when people enter. Now, as long as it's working along that lines, we're okay. But we do have some problems with pods, at least I do, and that is a loss of control in your lobby. I remember when supermarket branches first came out, one of the selling points that they used to tell us was it was never a successful supermarket branch robbery. Unfortunately, and as I said to the people trying to sell me one many years ago, that's because robbers haven't figured out how to rob it yet. So we're still in the early stages. Presently, robbers will take a look at this type of thing and generally will leave. But the loss of control is both on information security and on basic robbery security, because what happens is once I've entered the branch, can I get around behind the person at the pod? And I know of one institution that I'm told is now actually training a technique called pushback, which means pushing back people who are walking around the pod to see things. So consequently, we're giving our staff just a little more trouble with customers or account holders as they try to get around to see what's going on. So I have some problems there. We also have to make sure we have the right cameras in place so we can see both sides of the teller line here, or in this case, both sides of the pod. We have to be sure if we're running one of these branches that we actually do have somebody to greet people at the front door, like the Walmart greeter or the Apple greeter, because that's the person that's actually going to help us avoid a robbery in this type of installation. The person that first greets the people as they enter will actually be the one that the robber doesn't want to talk to, because once I get into the store, once I get into your branch, I have to go back past these people to exit the branch, not something a robber normally wants to do. So when I hear of somebody saying that they're doing a pod branch, my next question is, do you have a greeter at the pod branch? Do you have somebody directing things at the pod branch? Because that will increase your security. But if they're not going to staff that position, then I really think they better go back to the regular teller line, because then we can put up walls to protect and actually push back against people just going anywhere around the pods. In one institution that I had a little input to, they actually had doors coming from four different directions into their main office where they wanted to the pods. And I suggested to them that they actually do it in a circular format, and between each pod actually put a wall so somebody could not get along around behind them, so that the teller could stand in front of the wall, talk to people, handle her machinery, but at the same time protect anybody from actually getting to the actual equipment. So we will see a lot of changes with that. It's still in its infancy, and I'm waiting to see how different robbers actually react to this type of thing. So we really don't have enough experience with them yet to be able to give people really definitive things to handle it. But each institution that goes to a pod is going to find they're going to have to handle it just a little bit differently. And that requires them getting an architect who has a crime prevention through environmental design designation or something like us taking a look at what could possibly happen to them.
You've certainly given us a lot to think about there. When I take your advice and start thinking like a robber, one thing that comes to mind is sending someone in first to distract the greeter to create an opportunity. Thinking like the criminal is a great way to identify where you might have security issues. Great advice, Barry.
It's not enough to train your workforce. You also have to train the trainer. Now is the time to register for Train the Trainer Bootcamp. Whether you're brand new to the training arena or have clocked many miles in your role as a bank or credit union trainer, you will boost your ability to engage your learners and have attendees praising your training ability. Register now. Interaction-training.com.
We've talked about criminals coming into a financial institution to commit a crime. Let's shift our focus to internal embezzlement, a subject that makes everyone grit their teeth. You teach a program where you focus on the warning signs of internal embezzlement. Can you share with our listeners what to look for and how to expose this form of fraud?
You know, I can. I coined a term many years ago called DRAG, and it stands for drugs, relationships, alcohol, gambling. Depending on what the person may be involved with, it might cause a reason for why they would want to rob the institution that they're working for. And some of the things that we look at warning signs is people that are there all the time. This is an individual that will not arrive early, leave late. They don't take a vacation. They're always willing to help you. But they also, strangely enough, will be defensive about certain areas that they're working with. They don't want anybody in their area to balance something. And if we start to look at it, while I can understand, like, for example, a teller at night balancing and wanting to go through her material, his material, before anybody else does, if it becomes to a point of nobody can touch it, then I have a problem. Something is going wrong. The other thing that we look for is that they're refusing to be promoted. They don't want to be promoted. They don't want to leave that particular area. And the reason for it as many times is I'm making too much money stealing from the institution to want to be changed in my location. We also find that you'll see a change in their habits and lifestyle. So an individual that is hooked on drugs or going down that line may pick up the vocabulary of what a drug person would be using, or a gambler, and they're always going to some place to gamble. They always are leaving to go do this at the local casino or something. So we then see the changes in that way. We also have an exercise that we work with people many times about what do people spend the money on if they're not spending it on some of these things. It could be an individual. Well, sometimes with a class, I will actually pick myself and I'll say, what would a middle-aged man be doing if they were divorced? And what would I be spending my money on? And I always get a kick out of it because the audience immediately responds with, I'm going to be driving a sports car. It's going to be red. They know where I'm going to be living. Probably isn't the retirement area. It's going to be a place that's active with younger folks. Sometimes I kid them about what I'm wearing, what my girlfriend might look like, that type of deal. When we turn it around to the ladies, people will come back very quickly and they'll tell me that they are going to be buying their clothing at high-end stores. They're going to be spending for things many times that would improve their home. So a change in lifestyle, a change in cars, something that isn't quite there visible for us. I do know that one time I had a call where they told me that an individual was doing something funny, and I requested from them, well, where does the individual live? Oh, he has a beautiful home, about $215,000. Well, that's really nice, and he's got a wife and couple of kids. Well, that's nice too. And what do you folks pay this guy? And oh, by the way, what's his car? And he was driving a late model car that was very expensive. And when we got all finished with all that, they told us that he was being paid something like $50,000 a year. Well, that's a heck of a thing to be having in the background that this person has to handle on the salary that they were paying him. Could be other reasons for it. That doesn't necessarily mean the person's an internal embezzler. You have to look at many of these different warning signs to determine, do we have a problem here? Is the problem progressing? What do we need to see? So when I'm training security people, I train them quite a bit about what they have to be looking at. And one of the big things that I look for is, are we doing background checks? And not just background checks when somebody is hired, but background checks when somebody's promoted. Because I may have worked with your institution for 10 or 12 years, but I got in trouble doing something three or four counties away. It isn't really known here. And only in a background check would that be picked up. So consequently, when you're promoting somebody, you want to make sure that you're promoting somebody into a position of quality so that you don't have problems being built in for later on. So these are some of the warning signs that we look at when we're involved with internal embezzlement.
I know several of our clients, and yours too, I'm sure, have been up against that type of tragedy. It always ends up feeling like a great betrayal, and the chance for making things right is gone as soon as that trust is violated. In addition to embezzlement and security from a physical standpoint, I know that you've made comments before about internal fraud investigation. Can you tell us some things that you see financial institutions either neglecting to do or doing wrong when they conduct an internal fraud investigation?
Another really good question. Before an internal embezzlement ever hits, and a lot of institutions think, it's never going to happen here. I one time thought that too. I don't anymore. It's not a question of, will it ever happen? It's just a question of when it's going to happen to you. So before you get there, you should sit down and have a risk management committee, whatever you want to name this committee, looking at these type of things. And they have to make one decision. Who's going to actually handle the investigation when it occurs? You will actually find three people in almost every organization going to a war with each other when the internal embezzlement's discovered. And that would be HR, audit, and the security function. So consequently, they shouldn't be fighting with each other. The three have to really work together in advance of what they need to do. For example, if we suspected an internal embezzlement and we're looking at it, we're not sure yet, the internal auditor can go into all sorts of areas and find records without people becoming concerned that we are looking for a problem. The HR department can tell us if someone's experiencing problems, what's going on. And consequently, do we train anybody on how to handle the actual interview when we do have a problem? Because many times, there'll be three or four people involved. We don't know which one is the internal embezzler. So where the institution will make one of its biggest mistakes is the first one to find it, HR, security, audit, starts to do an investigation on it. And if they don't know the proper questions to ask, they could hamstring us so we never get the individual, or we have to let the individual go, but we can't say it's internal embezzlement, or we just got two people, we can't tell which one. So questions become, well, what do you ask somebody? Well, the very first question we ask in an internal investigation is, did you take the money? And many times the internal embezzlers tell us that they didn't agree to say they embezzled because nobody asked them if they did. They just talked about it in general in this interview. Secondly, the people have to be trained that's doing the interview in the right questions to ask. And there's a thing called Reed and Associates. It's out of Chicago. They go all over the United States. And they train people in a 3 or 4 day session about how to handle these type of investigations. So if none of these three people in your institution have been to a school like that, you're probably better off hiring somebody like a certified fraud examiner to do that investigation for you. You remove the liability from your people, and you also have someone that actually can read body language and know what's happening when they're having this discussion with your person. So we take the people out of their environment. Let's say it happened at a branch. We've got four people that we need to talk to. We take them out. We put them aside. And they may be expecting questions from us, like, tell us about how the transactions work, tell us about something. And those won't be the questions we're asking them at all at the beginning. One of the questions that I really like that is asked at this time period is, you have been under investigation for a long time. People have been looking at us or at you. Tell me, when I capture this individual or identify them, and I'm going to, what do you want us to do to them? Someone who is innocent will probably respond, put them in jail. Want them out of here. I don't want to work with a crook. Someone else might say, well, I don't know. I guess it's the reason that they did it. Maybe we should be helping them. Maybe there should be something there. And what I know immediately, honey, when they tell me that, is we're either dealing with the internal embezzler or we're dealing with a liberal. We're really not sure which it is. And I kind of say that tongue-in-cheek, kiddingly, because there is no one question that we can ask that is going to really say that person was the criminal. But we have to go through a series of questions with them, like what I'm talking about now. They're psychological. We watch how the people respond, and we start identifying dishonest answers. What's a dishonest answer? Well, I say to the individual, did you take the money? And the individual looks at me and says, what makes you think I took the money? Did they answer the question? No. They avoided the question. So we have to come back and ask them again, why did they take the money, so to speak, if they were the one that was the criminal. But generally, when somebody gives us a dishonest answer or a deflective answer, we have to start following that up. Now, if you have nobody on your staff trained to do that, then you better start talking about who you're going to get when it does happen. So on the day that somebody comes through the door and says, we've lost $100,000, and we got three people that are behind that, we've got to know who to ask and what to do, and not just sit down and think about, well, maybe we should do X or maybe we should do Y. I think these things need to be discussed in advance. And another problem that we find in these situations is the institution many times does not give these people a leave on pay. As soon as we know a person is involved with something, and we know there might be two or three, and we're going to question them, I realize that we may be short-staffed, but sometimes we have to take those people out of the environment. We don't fire them because we want them to still be linked with our institution so that they feel that they, to keep their jobs, they're willing to talk to us until we know exactly what happened. So it's kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but I think all of that is very important when you're talking about an internal embezzlement.
Well, that was very thought-provoking. I'm sure there's a lot of financial institutions that don't have a plan until there's a cause for concern. I think our listeners will really benefit from many of the ideas that you've brought to their attention. If anybody in our audience wanted to know more about what you do or how you could help them in one of these challenging situations, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, the fastest way is to go to tgroup.online.com. They can look at the various things that we teach, what we can do with them. They can call me anytime that they'd like to at area code 315-342-5931. Again, that's area code 315-342-5931. We do not charge anybody to call and talk to us about a problem if they have one. We take time with them to see what's going on. And, you know, sometimes that leads to other things that we don't expect. I've had calls where they call in to ask a question, and the next thing I know, we're on site doing a physical risk assessment because they got robbed because a tree was too big next to the door, the entry door to their institution, or they had never had anybody trained to look at these type of things. So they can feel free to call us there, or they can email us directly through that website. And while they're on the website, we also have a newsletter. It's one page. It's free. And it covers things. So each month we do an article about these type of situations we've run across. But perhaps what's more important is that we will answer a question a month on these type of things that we've been talking about today. So whatever they need, we're willing to help them with.
Well, Barry, this has been so informative and thought-provoking. A lot of things that you train on, consult about, are things we hope never happen, but a financial institution is at great risk if they haven't thought about what to do in the event of, or, as you talked about before, in the design of a physical location or in the training of their individuals. So we've loved having you as a guest today. We'd love to invite you back to talk more about other things that you've run into or ways that you could help our audience beef up their security and fraud prevention. But thank you so much for being a guest today, Barry, and I'll look forward to the next time.
Honey, it's been a great opportunity. I thank you so much for having us on with you today and look forward to working with you again in the future. Thank you.
You bet.
You've been listening to Training Matters with Honey Shelton.